Section 14 of The House Without a Key by Alda Biggers. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adopted freely for any purpose. Section 14. What Cola Carried. Several days slipped by so rapidly John Quincy scarcely noted their passing. Dan Winterslip was sleeping now under the royal palms of the lovely island where he had been born. Sun and moon shone brightly in turn on his last dwelling-place, but those who sought the person he had encountered that Monday night on his lanai were still groping in the dark. Hallett had kept his word. He was combing the islands for Braid. But Braid was nowhere. Ships paused at the crossroads and sailed again. The name of Thomas Maccan Braid was on no sailing list. Through far settlements that were called villages, but were nothing save clusters of Japanese huts, in lonely coves where the surf moaned dismally, over pineapple and sugar plantations, the emissaries of Hallett pursued their quest. Their efforts came to nothing. John Quincy drifted idly with the days. He knew now the glamour of Waikiki waters. He had felt their warm embrace. Every afternoon he experimented with a board in the Malahini surf, and he was eager for the moment when he could dare the big rollers farther out. Boston seemed like a tale that is told, State Street and Beacon memories of another more active existence now abandoned. No longer was he at a loss to understand his aunt's reluctance to depart these friendly shores. Early Friday afternoon Miss Minerva found him reading a book on the lanai. Something in the nonchalance of his manner irritated her. She had always been for action, and the urge was on her even in Hawaii. "Have you seen Mr. Chan lately?" she inquired. "Talked with him this morning. They're doing their best to find Braid." "Humph!" sniffed Miss Minerva. "Their best is none too good. I'd like to have a few Boston detectives on this case."
"Oh, give them time," yawned John Quincy.
"They've had 3 days," she snapped. "Time enough. Braid never left this island of Oahu, that's certain. And when you consider that you can drive across it in a motor in 2 hours, and around it in about 6, Mr. Hallett's brilliance does not impress. I'll have to end by solving this thing myself." John Quincy laughed. "Yes, maybe you will. Well, I've given them the 2 best clues they have. If they'd keep their eyes open the way I do..."
"Charlie's eyes are open," protested John Quincy.
"Think so? They look pretty sleepy to me." Barbara appeared on the lanai, dressed for a drive. Her eyes were somewhat happier. A bit of colour had come back to her cheeks.
"What are you reading, John Quincy?" she asked.
He held up the book. "The City by the Golden Gate," he told her.
"Oh, really? If you're interested, I believe Dad had quite a library on San Francisco. I remember there was a history of the Stock Exchange. He wanted me to read it, but I couldn't."
"You've missed a good one," John Quincy informed her. "I finished it this morning. I've read 5 other books on San Francisco since I came." His aunt stared at him.
"What for?" she asked.
"Well," he hesitated, "I've taken sort of a fancy to the town. I don't know. Sometimes I think I'd rather like to live there." Miss Minerva smiled grimly.
"And they sent you out to take me back to Boston," she remarked.
"Boston's all right," said her nephew hastily. "It's Winterslip headquarters, but its hold has never been strong enough to prevent an occasional Winterslip from hitting the trail. You know, when I came into San Francisco Harbor, I had the oddest feeling." He told them about it. "And the more I saw of the city, the better I liked it. There's a snap and sparkle in the air, and the people seem to know how to get the most out of life."
Barbara smiled on him approvingly.
"Follow that impulse, John Quincy," she advised.
"Maybe I will. All this reminds me, I must write a letter."
He rose and left the lanai. "Does he really intend to desert Boston?" Barbara asked. Miss Minerva shook her head.
"Just a moment's madness," she explained. "I'm glad he's going through it. He'll be more human in the future. But as for leaving Boston, John Quincy, as well expect Bunker Hill Monument to emigrate to England. In his room upstairs, however, John Quincy's madness was persisting. He had never completed that letter to Agatha Parker, but he now plunged into his task with enthusiasm. San Francisco was his topic, and he wrote well. He pictured the city in words that glowed with life, and he wondered, just a suggestion, how she'd like to live there. Agatha was now, he recalled, on a ranch in Wyoming, her first encounter with the West, and that was providential. She had felt for herself the lure of the wide open spaces. Well, the farther you went, the wider and opener they got. In California, life was all color and light. Just a suggestion, of course. As he sealed the flap of the envelope, he seemed to glimpse Agatha's thin, patrician face, and his heart sank. Her gray eyes were cool, so different from Barbara's, so very different from those of Carlotta Maria Egan. On Saturday afternoon, John Quincy had an engagement to play golf with Harry Jennison. He drove up Nuanu Valley in Barbara's roadster, for Dan Winterslip's will had been read, and everything he possessed was Barbara's now. In that sheltered spot a brisk rain was falling, as is usually the case, though the sun was shining brightly. John Quincy had grown accustomed to this phenomenon. Liquid sunshine, the people of Hawaii call such rain, and pay no attention to it. Half a dozen different rainbows added to the beauty of the country club links. Jennison was waiting on the veranda, a striking figure in white. He appeared genuinely glad to see his guest, and they set out on a round of golf that John Quincy would long remember. Never before had he played amid such beauty. The low hills stood on guard, their slopes bright with tropical colours, the yellow of kukai trees, the grey of ferns, the emerald of ohia and banana trees, here and there a splotch of brick-red earth. The course was a green velvet carpet beneath their feet. The showers came and went. Jennison was a proficient driver, but the boy was his superior on approaches, and at the end of the match John Quincy was 4 up. They putted through a rainbow and returned to the locker room. In the roadster going home, Jennison brought up the subject of Dan Winterslip's murder. John Quincy was interested to get the reaction of a lawyer to the evidence. "I've kept more or less in touch with the case," Jennison said. "Egan is still my choice." Somehow John Quincy resented this. A picture of Carlotta Egan's lovely but unhappy face flashed through his mind. "How about Leatherby and the Compton woman?" he asked. "Well, of course, I wasn't present when they told their story," Jennison replied. "But Hallett claims it sounded perfectly plausible, and it doesn't seem likely that he had had anything to do with the murder. Leatherby would have been fool enough to keep that page from the guest book." "There's Braid, too," John Quincy suggested. "Yes, Braid complicates things, but when they run him down, if they do, I imagine the result will be nil. You know that Kamaku's grandson is mixed up somehow with Braid." "So I understand. It's a matter that wants looking into. But mark my words, when all these trails are followed to the end, everything will come back to Jim Egan." "What have you against Egan?" inquired John Quincy, swerving to avoid another car. "I have nothing against Egan," Jennison replied. "But I can't forget the look on Dan Winterslip's face that day he told me he was afraid of the man. Then there is the stub of the Corsican cigarette. Most important of all, Egan's silence regarding his business with Winterslip. Men who are facing a charge of murder, my boy, talk and talk fast, unless it so happens that what they have to say would further incriminate them." They drove on in silence into the heart of the city. "Hallett tells me you're doing a little detective work yourself," smiled Jennison. "I've tried, but I'm a duffer," John Quincy admitted. "Just at present my efforts consist of a still hunt for that watch Aunt Minerva saw on the murderer's wrist. Whenever I see a wristwatch, I get as close to it as I can and stare. But as most of my sleuthing is done in the daytime, it isn't so easy to determine whether the numeral 2 is bright or dim." "Persistence," urged Jennison. "That's the secret of a good detective. Stick to the job and you may succeed yet." The lawyer was to dine with the family at Waikiki. John Quincy set him down at his office, where he had a few letters to sign, and then drove him out to the beach. Barbara was gowned in white. She was slim and wistful and beautiful, and considering the events of the immediate past, the dinner was a cheerful one. They had coffee on the lanai. Presently Jennison rose and stood by Barbara's chair. "We've something to tell you," he announced. He looked down at the girl. "Is that right, my dear?" Barbara nodded. "Your cousin and I," the lawyer turned to the two from Boston, "have been fond of each other for a long time. We shall be married very quietly in a week or so."
"Oh, Harry, not a week," said Barbara.
"Well, as you wish, but very soon."
"Yes, very soon," she repeated.
"And leave Honolulu for a time," Jennison continued. "Naturally, Barbara feels she could not stay here for the present. So many memories, you both understand. She's authorized me to put this house up for sale."
"But Harry," Barbara protested.
"You make me sound so inhospitable, telling my guests that the house is for sale and I am leaving."
"Nonsense, my dear," said Aunt Minerva. "John Quincy and I understand, quite. I sympathize with your desire to get away."
She rose. "I'm sorry," said Jennison. "I did sound a little abrupt, but I'm naturally eager to take care of her now."
"Of course," John Quincy agreed.
Miss Minerva bent over and kissed the girl.
"If your mother were here, dear child," she said,
"she couldn't wish for your happiness any more keenly than I do." Barbara reached up impulsively and put her arms around the older woman. John Quincy shook Jennison's hand.
"You're mighty lucky."
"I think so," Jennison answered. The boy went over to Barbara.
All good wishes," he said.
She nodded but did not reply. He saw there were tears in her eyes. Presently Miss Minerva withdrew to the living room, and John Quincy, feeling like a fifth wheel, made haste to leave the two together. He went out on the beach. The pale moon rode high amid the golden stars. Romance whispered through the coconut palms. He thought of the scene he had witnessed that breathless night on the President Tyler. Only two in the world, love quick and overwhelming. Well, this was the setting for it. Here on this beach they had walked two and two since the beginning of time, whispering the same vows, making the same promises, whatever their color and creed. Suddenly the boy felt lonely. Barbara was a winter slip, and not for him. Why then did he feel again that frustrated pang in his heart? She had chosen, and her choices were fitting. What affair was it of his? He found himself moving slowly toward the Reef and Palm Hotel. For a chat with Carlotta Egan? But why should he want to talk with this girl, whose outlook was so different from that of the world he knew? The girls at home were on a level with the men in brains. Often, indeed, they were superior, seemed to be looking down from a great height. They discussed that article in the latest Atlantic, Shaw's Grim Philosophy, the new sergeant at the art gallery. Wasn't that the sort of talk he should be seeking here? Or was it? Under these palms on this romantic beach, with the moon riding high over Diamond Head, Carlotta Egan was seated behind the desk in the deserted lobby of the Reef and Palm, a worried look on her face. "You've come at the psychological moment," she cried and smiled. "I'm having the most awful struggle." "Arithmetic?" John Quincy inquired.
"Compound fractions, it seems to me. I'm making out the Braid's bill." He came round the desk and stood at her side.
"Let me help you."
"It's so fearfully involved."
She looked up at him, and he wished they could do their sums on the beach. "Mr. Braid has been away since Tuesday morning, and we don't charge for any absence of more than 3 days, so that comes out of it."
"Maybe you can figure it. I can't."
"Charge him anyhow," suggested John Quincy.
"I'd like to. That would simplify everything, but it's not Dad's way."
John Quincy took up a pencil. "What rate are they paying?" he inquired. She told him and began to figure. It wasn't a simple manner even for a bond expert. John Quincy frowned too. Someone entered the front door of the Reef and Palm. Looking up, John Quincy beheld the Hawaiian boy, Dick Kohler. He carried a bulky object wrapped in newspapers. "Mr. Braid here now?" he asked. Carlotta Egan shook her head. "No, he hasn't returned." "I will wait," said the boy. "But we don't know where he is or when he will come back," the girl protested. "He will be here soon," the Hawaiian replied. "I wait on the lanai." He went out the side door, still carrying his clumsy burden. John Quincy and the girl stared at each other. "We move, we advance," John Quincy quoted in a low voice. "Braid will be here soon. Would you mind going out on the lanai and telling me where Kola is now?" Quickly the girl complied. She returned in a few seconds. "He's taken a chair at the far end." "Out of earshot?" "Quite." "You want the telephone?" But John Quincy was already in the booth. Charlie Chan's voice came back over the wire. "Most warm congratulations. You are number one detective yourself. Should my self-starter not indulge in stubborn spasm, I will make immediate connection with you." John Quincy returned to the desk, smiling. "Charlie's flying to us in his Ford. Begins to look as though we were getting somewhere now. But about this bill. Mrs. Braid's board and room I make $16. The charge against Mr. Braid, 1 week's board and room minus 4 days' board, totals $9.62.
"How can I ever thank you?" said the girl.
"By telling me again about your childhood on this beach." A shadow crossed her face. "Oh, I'm sorry, I've made you unhappy." "Oh, no, you couldn't." She shook her head. "I've never been so very happy. Always an if in it, as I told you before. That morning on the ferry I think I was nearest to real happiness. I seemed to have escaped from life for a moment. I remember how you laughed at my hat. Oh, I hope you've forgiven me." "Nonsense. I'm mighty glad I was able to make you laugh like that." Her great eyes stared into the future, and John Quincy pitied her. He had known others like her, others who loved their fathers, built high hopes for them, then saw them drift into a baffled old age. One of the girl's slender tanned hands lay on the desk. John Quincy put his own upon it. "Don't be unhappy," he urged. "It's such a wonderful night. The moon, you're a, what you may call it, a kumaina, I know, but I'll bet you never saw the moon looking so well before. It's like a $1,000 gold piece, pale but negotiable. Shall we go out and spend it?" Gently she drew her hand away. There were 7 bottles of charged water sent to the room, 35 cents each. "What?" "Oh, the Braid's bill. Yes, that means 2.45 more. I'd like to mention the stars, too. Isn't it odd how close the stars seem in the tropics?" She smiled. "We mustn't forget the trunks and bags. $3 for bringing them up from the dock." "Say, that's rather steep. Well, it goes down on the record. Have I ever told you that all this natural beauty out here has left its imprint on your face? In the midst of so much loveliness, one couldn't be anything but..." "Mrs. Braid had 3 trays to the room. That's 75 cents more." "Extravagant lady. Braid will be sorry he came back, for more reasons than one. Well, I've got that. Anything else?" "Just the laundry. 97 cents. "Fair enough. Adding it all up, I get $32.69. Let's call it an even 33. She laughed. "Oh, no, we can't do that." Mrs. Braid came slowly into the lobby from the lanai. She paused at the desk. "Has there been a message?" she inquired. "No, Mrs. Braid," the girl answered. She handed over the slip of paper. "Your bill." "Ah, yes, Mr. Braid will attend to this the moment he returns." "You expect him soon?" "I really can't say." The Englishwoman moved on into the corridor leading to 19. "Full of information as usual," smiled John Quincy. "Why, here's Charlie now." Chan came briskly to the desk, followed by another policeman, also in plain clothes. "Automobile act noble," he announced, having fondly feeling for night air. He nodded toward his companion. "Introducing Mr. Spencer. Now what are the situation? Humbly hinting you speak fast." John Quincy told him Kola was waiting on the lanai and mentioned the unwieldy package carried by the boy. Chan nodded. "Events are turning over rapidly," he said. He addressed the girl. "Please kindly relate to this caller that Braid has arrived and would wish to encounter him here." She hesitated. "No, no," added Chan hastily. "I forget nice heath and delicacy. It is not pretty I should ask a lady to scatter false lies from ruby lips. I humbly demand forgiveness. Content yourself with a veiled pretext bringing him here." The girl smiled and went out. "Mr. Spencer," said Chan, "I make bold to suggest you interrogate this Hawaiian. My reckless wanderings among worlds of unlimitable English language often fail to penetrate sort of scores plentiful round here." Spencer nodded and went to the side door, standing where he would not be seen by anyone entering there. In a moment Kola appeared, followed by the girl. The Hawaiian came in quickly, but seeing Chan, stopped, and a frightened look crossed his face. Spencer startled him further by seizing his arm. "Come over here," said the detective. "We want to talk to you." He led the boy to a far corner of the room. Chan and John Quincy followed. "Sit down. Here. I'll take that." He removed the heavy package from under the boy's arm. For a moment the Hawaiian seemed about to protest, but evidently he thought better of it. Spencer placed the package on a table and stood over Kola. "Want to see Braid, eh?" he began in a threatening tone. "Yes." "What for?" "Business is private." "Well, I'm telling you to come across. You're in bad. Better change your mind and talk." "No." "All right. We'll see about that. What have you got in that package?" The boy's eyes went to the table, but he made no answer. Chan took out a pocket knife. "Simple matter to discover," he said. He cut the rough twine, unwound several layers of newspapers. John Quincy pressed close. He felt that something important was about to be divulged. The last layer of paper came off. "Hot dog!" cried Chan. He turned quickly to John Quincy. "Oh, I am sorry. I pick up atrocious phrase like that from my cousin Mr. Willie Chan, captain of all Chinese baseball team." But John Quincy did not hear. His eyes were glued to the object that lay on the table. An Ohio woodbox bound with copper, the initials TMB. "We will unlatch it," said Chan. He made an examination. "No, locked most strongly. We will crash into it at police station, where you and I and this silent Hawaiian boy will now hasten. Mr. Spencer, you will remain on spot here. Should Braid appear, you know your duty." "I do," says Spencer. "Mr. Kola, do me the honour to accompany," continued Chan. "At police headquarters, much talk will be extracted out of you." They turned toward the door. As they did so, Carlotta Egan came up. "May I speak to you a moment?" she said to John Quincy. "Surely." He walked with her to the desk. "I went to the lanai just now," she whispered breathlessly. "Someone was crouching outside the window near where you were talking. I went closer, and it was Mr. Saladin." "Aha," said John Quincy. "Mr. Saladin had better drop that sort of thing, or he'll get himself in trouble. Should we tell Chan?" "Not yet. You and I'll do a little investigating ourselves first. Chan has other things to think about. And we don't want any of our guests to leave unless it's absolutely necessary." "We certainly don't," she smiled. "I'm glad you've got the interests of the house at heart." "That's just where I've got them," John Quincy began, but Chan cut in. "Humbly begging pardon," he said, "we must speed. Captain Hallett will have high delight to encounter this caller, to say nothing of Ohio woodbox." In the doorway, Kola crowded close to John Quincy, and the latter was startled by the look of hate he saw in the boy's stormy eyes. "You did this," muttered the Hawaiian. "I don't forget." End of section 14.